We have two readings this morning. In the book of Genesis, in the Hebrew scriptures, after God created the heavens and the earth and separated the light from the darkness, he filled the waters and land and sky with every type of living creature. We pick up the story in verse 26 of the first chapter of the book of Genesis. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good.
Our second reading this morning is about Native American spiritualities. And it's by the same reverend who wrote the breathing meditation that we did earlier, Reverend Mike Johnson. But in honor of Native American spiritualities, I want to name the natives who lived on this land before the Europeans came. I attended a talk at the Sacramento Historical Society a couple of weeks ago, and I learned about the Nisenan people who lived in this area for generations. It was a densely populated area. People who were studying the natives thought that because they didn't cultivate crops, they weren't a civilized people. But they saw themselves as stewards of the land, and by carefully stewarding the plants and the fish and the animals, they had abundant supplies and all the food they needed for a good life. And now here's the reading from Mike Johnson. "Non-Indigenous people who seek to reconnect with the earth must be wary of the dangerous problem of spiritual theft. On the one hand, we have much to learn from Native peoples about this land and about what it means to honor our relationship to the land. We must take our lead from those who have been living here for millennia, who have the knowledge that comes from belonging to a place. And they have shared much of this knowledge with all of us. But in our search for help, we can also do damage because of the context of the broken bonds between us, because of ongoing societal oppression and colonization. Native spiritual traditions are not for sale. They are inextricably woven into the network of relationships of Native communities and of the particular lands in which those communities live. Spirituality is a fundamental element of the Native struggles against the deconstruction of their cultures and homes. Perhaps their most important resource to heal their own broken connections with the land and their ancestors. Their spiritual traditions are not meant to be exported piecemeal for some other purpose, however earnest that purpose may be. Please don't spend your money on so-called Native spirituality workshops. Don't try to steal someone else's culture. Do your own spiritual work. Research the stories of your ancestors. Learn their names and their birthplaces. Trace the journeys that brought them to the land where you now reside. Learn their stories of their brokenness and their connections. Ask them to help you find your way.
Gardening for me is a deeply spiritual practice. It evokes beauty, mystery, peacefulness, humility, community, and faith. When I was a child, visits to my grandmother's house could be very tense. Although I loved her very much, I knew she could be harsh, especially with my parents. I often found refuge in her gardens, which were lush and full of hidden wonders. There were small statues hidden among the greenery, and I loved finding all of them. My favorite was a ceramic Chinese dragon, which now lives in my garden and reminds me of my grandmother. When Dan and I were newly married, I got my first grown-up garden in a community garden in Arlington, Virginia, which is a suburb right outside Washington, D.C. Plots were in high demand, so I was pretty surprised when after just 6 months, I got a plot. I soon discovered why so many people had passed over this one. A prior gardener had planted horseradish, which is very invasive and very hard to get rid of. But I was young, full of energy, determination, and pride. I would conquer the horseradish. And here is where I learned humility. I never fully got rid of the horseradish, but I was able to work around it and had a pretty good garden. I also found a community. The DC area is a bustling city. Everyone is working hard to get ahead. It is a who you know, what you do, how much you make, what is your five-year plan kind of place. I found it stressful and exhausting. The community garden, in contrast, was full of people who loved playing in the dirt and wanted to give their words of wisdom to the rookie garden and all the rookie gardener and her plot full of horseradish. Since then, I've had a garden everywhere I've lived. Working the soil, mulching, weeding, planting, watering, trimming, and pruning are all exercises in mindfulness. Gardening is the ultimate be in the moment, a literal stop and smell the roses. When I garden, I'm often eye level with the ground, which allows me to view things up close and to really see the beauty and wonder in the natural world. Not just the obviously beautiful, the butterfly or the flower, but the equally fascinating spider, worm, or bug. In the garden, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. To many, Queen Anne's lace is just a weed on the side of the road. To me, it's beautiful and always has a place of honor in my gardens. Gardening is an act of faith and letting go. I can follow all the instructions on soil prep, water needs, sunlight, but I have no idea whether that plant is going to grow and thrive. There are just too many variables. So when it does grow, every time it's a miracle, and I never cease to be amazed. I could go on and on. Most gardeners love to talk about their gardens, but I will end with this. I fill my gardens with love, but never with horseradish.
On the wall in my kitchen, and our kitchen borders on the family room, so I see this cross stitch every day. It says, "Yours is the earth and everything in it." It was made by my spouse's mother, and it has special sentimental value for her. I thought for a long time that it came from the Hebrew scriptures. Sounded kind of like the same idea that you heard in the reading about Genesis, but it actually came from the poem If by Rudyard Kipling. And the poem lists a bunch of qualities of manhood, moral qualities. It's a morality poem. And if all these qualities are achieved, then yours is the earth and everything in it. So while this didn't come from the Hebrew scriptures, it certainly has the same sentiment as we learned in that reading from Genesis that Roger shared with you. Earth was given by God to serve the needs of humans. Man is encouraged to subdue the earth. We're doing a pretty good job of it, wouldn't you say? Now, you may be thinking, well, I don't believe that. I'm into this interconnected thing of you. I don't believe in that. But it is how Western culture, and perhaps modern culture in the whole world, it is how we act. We act as if the earth is a resource, an input into the capitalist system created for the benefit of humans. And this is the cultural context we must shift in order to save ourselves from extinction. Can you imagine what kind of world it would be if our culture was based on a scripture that stated that the earth was God or was a goddess rather than being created by one? Can you imagine if the scriptures that we draw from said that humans should be tuned into a sacred relationship of trust and interdependence with the earth? Can you imagine how different things would be? There's another segment in Genesis that tells the creation story again, where man is actually created from earth. God takes the clay of the ground and creates Adam. We are of the earth. We are from the earth. And yet we've lost that connection many centuries ago through a religious focus on the idea of heaven as the goal, not earth, and actually seeing things of the earth as debased and unclean. We lost this connection to the earth through industrialization, capitalism, and consumerism. And yet we need this connection now more than ever. Sometimes I feel like we're more polarized than we've ever been on these issues, but I think that's kind of a media. The media gives us that idea, because we are also at a time of the greatest possibility of rapid change. And I think it's embodied by an image on Facebook the past week that showed Trump looking out and Greta Thunberg, the climate activist from Sweden, behind him, shooting daggers at him. And the caption under Trump said, dinosaur, and the caption under Greta said, asteroid. Change is going to come. But up to now, change has come slowly. There has been a lot of shifting that started in the mid-20th century, like so many things started to shift in our culture. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring raised our awareness of what we do and how it impacts the earth. Earth Day was started in 1970. I remember in my junior high school class, one of the teachers started the Ecology Club in honor of Earth Day, and our symbol was two boomerangs that formed an E. The message being that whatever you did to the earth would come back and affect you. I don't really remember what we did as a club, but I remember those boomerangs. In building our connections with the earth over the past few decades, science has helped us change our thinking quite a bit. New channels of scientific thought, interdisciplinary research, have brought to light how plants and animals are far more sophisticated than we ever understood, and that we are all part of a natural interdependent system. But I don't think knowledge is enough for the systemic change we need in the way we relate to the earth. Knowledge is not enough for us to give up our destructive habits. We need a more visceral change, a more visceral motivation, one that leads us into the sacred connections that many of us long for. And we have been seeking these connections for some time now. During the 70s, 80s, and continuing to now, many people of European heritage have turned to Native American and indigenous religions to reestablish their connections to the earth. We must be careful when we draw from these sources for our own spiritual practices, as we learned in the reading. We must be aware of the history that in establishing the United States, our ancestors killed the majority of Native Americans present on the land. Whether through the diseases that were brought from Europe, wars, or outright genocide. Our ancestors did their best to wipe out Native culture. And as Reverend Johnson said in the reading, in our search for help, we can also do damage because of the context of the broken bonds between us, because of ongoing societal oppression. When we draw from Native spirituality, we must do so in the context of honoring this history. But what I really appreciate in the reading is her suggestion that in our search for connections to the earth, we draw from the wisdom of our own ancestors. And this wisdom from our ancestors, as with any indigenous religion, is earth-centered, embodied, and celebrated through ritual. It is through this longing for connection to ancestors, longing for a different way of relating to the earth, that neo-pagan and goddess religions have flourished in the last 40 years. So before I go any further, let's clarify the origin of this word right up front. The word pagan simply means rural or rustic or of the earth. But many of you know that pagan is a loaded word, loaded by the early Christian church when it divided people into those within the church and those outside. In the early days of Christianity, everyone who was not Christian was pagan, particularly those who believed in many gods rather than one, or those who based their worship on the celebration of the seasons of the earth. Many of the pagan celebrations in early Europe were usurped by the Christian holidays, such as Yule being supplanted by Christmas, spring equinox by Easter, and Samhain or Halloween for All Souls Day. A lot is lost from that era, but since the 1970s, neo-pagan and goddess religions have been reclaiming these old ways, the wisdom of the people who lived in deeper connection to the earth, and bringing them into contemporary reality, drawing from their own ancestors. For the ancient pagans, understanding and celebrating the patterns of nature, the cycles of earth, the cycles of life, was crucial to survival. Reclaiming this wisdom is crucial to our survival now in the 21st century. Unitarian Universalists have been an important part of the resurgence in earth-based spiritualities. Within our denomination, we've spawned many different forms of pagan and goddess spirituality, and we've sponsored others outside of our church. And in many ways, earth-based spiritualities have transformed the Unitarian Universalist movement. Let me take you back about 40 years to 1977. When the Women and Religion resolution was endorsed by General Assembly. That resolution called on us to examine the relationship between religious and cultural attitudes towards women and to avoid sexist assumptions and language. So what resulted from that resolution is the change in the words in our hymns to eliminate words like mankind, replace them with humankind, and a revision of the original principles that were developed in 1961 when Unitarians and Universalists merged. And at the time of revising those principles is when the seventh principle came into being. The seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Many have argued that the seventh principle is the most significant theological shift in Unitarian Universalists for decades and may well be the frame of a UU theology for the 21st century. But more on that in a future sermon. Also from the Women and Religion resolution came a curriculum called Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. It was published in 1986, and it was written by Shirley Rank, a minister in this congregation in the late 90s. The curriculum focused on reclaiming God the Mother, drawing on ancient matriarchal religions that honor the feminine in all its manifestations and honor the earth as well. This curriculum met a longing that many women didn't know that they had. Starhawk, a leader in the neo-pagan movement, spoke about feminine, the divine feminine, and the power for women by saying that the image of the goddess inspired women to see ourselves as divine, our bodies as sacred, the changing phases of our life as holy. It doesn't seem so radical now, but in the 70s and 80s, those words felt like a balm to a hurting soul of many women. CAKES, as the curriculum became called, spawned groups of women practicing goddess spirituality in UU churches, including here at UUSS. In 1989, five women got together in this church, five women who were inspired by the curriculum CAKES for the Queen of Heaven, and tentatively and open-heartedly began practicing goddess spirituality and pagan ritual. One of the group, and they spawned at least 100 women in five or six groups participating as well. One of those groups, at least one of those groups, is still ongoing. During the same time of this fertile time for earth-based spiritualities, the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans was chartered in 1987. It's an organization dedicated to networking pagan-identified Unitarian Universalists and developing and promoting paganism in our denomination. The organization is alive and well today. And finally, in our historical tour in 1995, the sixth source was added to our sources of living tradition. Those of you who are familiar with Unitarian Universalism know we have seven principles, and we had five sources that we draw on for our inspiration. The sixth source, spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions, which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. That source was added in 1995, a result of all of this churning that had been happening around goddess spirituality, paganism, and a deeper connection to the earth. Now, at the time, I was there at General Assembly when that source was added, and it wasn't unanimous. Some folks went to the dissent microphone and made an argument that we should wait to see if these ideas take hold before we change one of our sources. Ancient wisdom of the earth. So I've talked quite a bit about paganism, and I want to invite all of you here to a planning meeting and full moon ritual next Sunday. There's an insert about it in the order of service. We're going to talk a little bit about what we can do, what our interest is in practicing earth-based spiritualities, and we're going to share a celebration of the full moon. You are welcome if you are respectfully curious. You are welcome if you are eager to find out more, and you are welcome if you are ready to step into leadership for future events and rituals. But pagan and goddess practice are not the only forms of earth-based spiritual practice. Many of us are deeply engaged in care for the earth, in connecting with the earth. But I think we need more than reading, recycling, and protesting if we're able to save ourselves and save our earth. We need sacred connections. We need a visceral and soulful awareness of our interconnection to all life. Shirley Rank, the minister from here who created CAKES, and Margot Adler, another early pagan, Unitarian Universalist, you may recognize, who was a reporter on National Public Radio. They both describe how we must shift from the idea of the divine as transcendent, out there, to immanent. God or goddess or the energy of the divine, however you see it, is not separate, but here, immanent, present, present in everything that is alive and vital. This divine spirit is the glue that holds together the interdependent web of all existence. So how are you called? How are you called to connect the earth? What form will your earth-based practice, your earth-based spiritual practice take? How will you choose to reconnect with the earth? Hiking, gardening, tree planting, forest bathing, a Japanese practice of going into the forest and being present with the energies that are there. Political action for the environment with a sacred awareness of the earth. Saying grace, living with gratitude, whatever calls you. The time to be complacent is over. We must get up. We must get out and do something. Reclaim, reconnect, restore our connections to the earth. And whatever you choose to do, or whatever you're currently doing, make it embodied. Dance in a meadow, hug a tree, lie in a field, and study the clouds passing by. Allow yourself to be moved and inspired. Whatever you do, let it be with gratitude and the intention to feel the earth and the connection to all living things. It is only through these sacred connections that we can truly make the changes needed to save humankind from extinction. Years ago, I attended a workshop that included a presentation from Meinrad Craighead, an artist and activist, one of the major proponents of the divine as feminine and connection to the earth. I was in awe of her. I saw her almost like an earth goddess herself. We were all enraptured with what she had to say, listening to every wise word that came out of her mouth. She offered to take questions from the group, and someone raised their hand and said, "What kind of spiritual practices do you have that help you stay connected to the earth and to the life force?" I don't remember anything else about her talk, but I remember how she answered this question. We all were waiting with bated breath for the wisdom of the oracle. So she smiled and she said, "When I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is pee. And I feel gratitude for the life force that gave me this amazing body that takes care of itself. And then I drink a glass of water, and I feel deep gratitude and connection to the earth that sustains me and sustains all life." And then she smiled the beautiful smile of an earth goddess. Blessed be.